Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 544. It is October 19th, 2017, and I am your host, James Jones. With me today is Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Guillaume Vaillette.
Hi.
And not John Lindemann, because he texted me and I told him that I would say he got arrested for some kind of unspeakable crime, but I'm too lazy to think of what that crime is, so I'm not going to do that. He was busy at work. So instead, we are joined today by Karen.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm law-abiding, so that's good.
Well, then you don't fit in on this show. Because this show has just turned into unspeakable horrors. But we're going to be on our best behavior this week, which is going to be a heck of a lot easier because one of the two people responsible for this isn't here. So actually, Karen and Guillaume, why don't you start us off this week?
Sure. Well, from the library again, I got a game, Hyrule Warriors, which I had been curious about, but not paying $80 curious about. And so it's very convenient that I managed to get it for free. And so we started playing that, Karen and I. And I did not expect, well, I was hoping, I knew that there was a mode, a co-op mode that used, you know, the gamepad so that one player played on the gamepad, the other person used a TV. So, you know, that was reason enough to at least try it out. But I wasn't sure if Karen was going to enjoy it. But as it turns out, you know, we've been playing a lot of beat-em-ups recently. And Dynasty Warriors, the series that this is kind of modeled after, is very much kind of a beat-em-up where you're, you know, outside of the fact that you're often confused about what your objectives are supposed to be, and that there's a map that you can get lost in, like, it's kind of a 3D beat-em-up where you just punch dude after dude after dude. So, yeah, it turns out that Karen kind of took to it a little bit more than I thought she would.
Well, it's really my kind of game. I like it. Sort of got that element of button mashing and like cool, you know, special moves that aren't too hard to memorize. And in fact, you can just sort of make up a combination on the gamepad and do something cool. So it's kind of, I mean, for me, it's kind of like the ideal game that way. There's a lot of variation in it, as opposed to a game like what game do we play? What beat 'em up do we play? Where, you know, you only have four or five moves. This one's pretty cool because, you know, you get, and the, you know, the graphics are good and the story is okay, although we skip through a lot of the cutscenes. But yeah.
Yeah, you want to talk about the cutscenes? Cutscenes. There's one at the beginning that made you roll your eyes when the villain is introduced, or her origin story is explained.
Right. I can't remember what her origin story. Well, I don't. I guess I know what her origin story was. But yeah, of course. I mean, I'm. I guess I'm easily shockable. So I. You know. I was a bit. Surprised at her chestiness, her bustiness, and her clothing. I mean, it kind of struck me as like, I, you know, when I think of Zelda, I don't exactly think wholesome, you know, video game entertainment, but I sort of wasn't really expecting that. So it was, that was a bit eye-rolly. You know, she's pretty well endowed and not wearing a whole lot of clothing, which is, I guess, par for the course in a lot of games. But
yeah, but also like the fact that she lets evil escape and
oh
why?
yeah, I forget, why does she let evil escape? She's distracted by
a
man.
Crush on Link.
She's distracted by a boy.
That's right. Sorry, I forgot about it. I guess I tried to erase it from my memory.
She's got a murder crush. It's really intense.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of patience for that shit. So I kind of forgot it. But yeah, that was pretty problematic. And I don't know, like, well, even just like we just finished the game, right? And at one point I'm, you know, beating up bosses. I'm going after two guys at a time and they're difficult. And then Link beats someone and Zelda says, "Oh, Link, you're such a great hero. You're really taking to this hero role." And I thought, hey, I'm a hero. I just killed two guys, you know, two major villains. So, you know, that kind of stuff kind of bugs me, but I like that.
I think that's mostly due to the fact that we're playing co-op, and the game is kind of written for a single player, I suppose.
Yeah,
so you're
no,
meant
definitely.
To be, yeah, because I'm player one. The game is like defaults to like, oh, Link, you're awesome. And I suppose that the other Zelda is the one saying that. But then there's a second Zelda on the battlefield that you're controlling. And I guess the Zelda actress didn't record her lines to say, "Oh, Zelda, you're so awesome," because that would, you know, that sounds a little bit
narcissistic.
Yeah, yeah, kind of.
I am so great.
Just, yeah.
That game, and you're right, that game's story is definitely story by Tecmo Koei and character design by Tecmo Koei, and the two original characters are ridiculous in their own awful way. Because the other one's like a pop idol running around the stage.
She's terrible too. And she giggles, and it's so awful. I mean, she's a cool character, Al, when it comes down to it. She's a wizard, a wizardess, what do you call it? Is she a witch? Okay, yeah, sorry. Like, she's pretty cool in terms of her powers, but yeah, kind of flaky. Oh, and the worst one is Agatha with the butterflies and the little girl. Like, she looks like a version of Little Red Riding Hood, but more pornographic.
Yeah, but Nintendo owns that one, so I can't blame anybody for that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was one of the more unsettling characters from Twilight Princess.
And she was supposed to be in that game. Like, in that game, she was supposed to be off-putting and, like, really unpleasant to be around. In this one, they just sort of said, like, oh, look, she's here. She likes bugs.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been kind of marathoning through it. In fact, like, we just... quote-unquote saw the credits right before we came here to record, and I say quote-unquote saw because we actually didn't watch them, and that kind of goes for a lot of the cutscenes in the game. Like, you know, I was not too engaged in the lore of this game and the story, and there sure is a lot of exposition and a lot of scenes where you see the characters emote and hear them like moan and groan and stuff like that and breathe, which prompted at some point Karen to say, like, will you stop fucking breathing?
that's dark.
It is dark, and it just sounds ridiculous, especially when you're reading the text that they're saying. Like, the game does have voice acting. There's like interstitial, like during the load screens, there's kind of the story so far with the narrator just, you know, going on about, what just happened with the thing that you just saw.
And she's quite good. I actually quite like the narrator's voice. It's just, there's too much of it.
Yeah, there's too much of it. And the content, you know, what she's reading is... not super great. So, you know, I was not too engaged, but I still, like, I wasn't sure, like, oh, like, there's press plus to skip the cutscene, and I don't know what to do. And eventually, I'm just like, do you want me to skip this? And Karen's just like, yes. So, we're on the same page on that. But yeah, it's still, like, I enjoy the game, but as I said, we kind of marathoned through it. I could have stood playing one less mission per night than we have been, you know, take it a little bit more easy, but it's kind of due to, you know, I'm on a timer here. Like, I'm a,
well, yeah, and
we
that's
have to return
the thing.
The game.
Sorry. But yeah, you're on the timer, but you're actually on almost a literal timer in the game too. That's my biggest complaint about the game is I felt we were kind of pushed through the game, you know, like I felt like, oh, we have to do this next thing. Like, you're always prompted to do the next thing, like help Lana and, you know, oh, go help this person and go help that person. Oh, your keep is in danger of falling. And, you know, so it doesn't feel like you can explore the game, and there's a lot to explore. You know, I mean, and the what is it? The Sculptulas, they appear and you don't have time to look for them because you're doing other stuff. So, you know, I feel like, yeah, it's, I mean, based on, I watched you play Breath of the Wild, and, you know, I really enjoyed that. I mean, you know, the whole basis of that game is to explore and you know, just explore the worlds. But this, it's nice to look at, but you don't have that leisure.
Yeah, it's kind of on purpose, right? Like they want you to make you choose between like the next objective and explore and find the hidden secrets.
Right.
I think the bigger problem is that the map is not super helpful a lot of times, and sometimes the game is just like so buggy that it's hard to know if you're following the instructions incorrectly or if the game is just kind of you know, having a moment, like
lags.
Like,
it lags behind the story, lags behind your achievements. So sometimes, like, it tells you to go rescue. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, tonight, like, I killed Zent in the next to last level, or the last level, I can't remember. And he just laid there, like, on the ground, not doing anything. And he was, yeah, I had beaten him. And the game kept saying, like, oh, go meet up with Lana. And we do that a bunch of times. She never does anything. It's like, okay, well, I guess we're going to keep beating up the dudes that keep appearing. And eventually, after like 5-10 minutes, the game finally realizes, oh, you've defeated Zant. You know, now we can move on to the next thing. So it's just like the there's a certain degree of confusion whenever you're playing this game. I find like it's and it's not always on purpose. You know, it's not always like because of you know. Sometimes it's because of bad design. Sometimes it's because of bad execution. And
How does it manage having a output to the second screen at the same time? You got any idea of the sort of concessions in terms of the, you know, like how many enemies are on screen and all that kind of stuff? Or have you not played it enough on its own to know?
Yeah, I only did one solo mission in the kind of the... I can't remember what the name of the mode is, but the throwback to the first Zelda, the adventure mode.
The 8-bit map. Yeah,
and I think that the draw distance was further. Like I think that the enemies could be seen from further away. Sometimes I'm the one playing on the gamepad, and sometimes like I'll go next to an outpost, and there's always like an outpost captain near them that you have to defeat. And there have been times when I got right up to the outpost before the captain appeared out of thin air. So there's a lot of that going on. So yeah, like you have to again look at the mini map where there's like masses of red or big blotches of red, and you go in the middle of there and you hope that the enemies are actually going to be there, like that they're going to appear, and that you're going to be able to beat them up. But yeah, like it's a, I don't know, it's a fun formula, and I think like it's a good replacement, or yeah, like it's a good thing to jump to after we've been playing all these 2D beat 'em ups, and it's probably a good like you know, cost versus time like value compared to playing Final Fight, you know. Final Fight, you go through it on hard, and it takes you maybe half an hour, and then, okay, I guess we're done. Whereas this just keeps, you know, throwing new missions at you.
There's a lot of it, and somehow there was a lot of DLC as well.
There was an unreasonable amount of DLC.
Hmm.
But that's sort of par for the course for these Tecmo Koei games. They'll produce a game and then put out 600 pieces of DLC.
So now, you know, I told Karen that there's a Fire Emblem Warriors coming out on the Switch tomorrow as of this recording. And so, yeah, like Karen was kind of interested in playing that, even though like you don't have any experience with Fire Emblem.
No. I think I've seen you play something, you know, now and again, but I'm not familiar with the characters, but...
Right. And yeah. I kind of don't like the franchise or the series, so I'm not super familiar with the characters mm-hmm. either that are going to be in the Fire Emblem Warriors, but yeah, I don't know. Like, it might not be that much of a negative because... as I said, like we ended up skipping the cutscenes anyway. Like the characters in Hyrule Warriors are not that much of what draws us to the game. So
no, it's true. Although I really liked playing as Zelda. I hadn't done that before. Like I played a couple of Zelda games, but I'd never played as Zelda, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it was.
What do we know about the multiplayer options on Switch?
As far as I can tell, it's split screen. So
right.
That's how they usually handle it for these Warriors games. I would assume that's the case.
The unfortunately, Nintendo World Report did not get a review code, or I don't know.
We did not, last I heard.
Right. So we don't have a review up so far. I'm sure we're going to try to get one up as soon as you know, one of the people working for the website gets through it and writes a review.
The challenge with that, as you probably have surmised, is that there's a lot to these games, and you guys haven't even attempted the big mode, that like that big non-story mode that takes forever.
Right.
So it could take some time to get a review out.
Mm. Yeah. From what I've seen from European reviews, though, it seems like the game has, you know, is not super technically proficient, which is kind of expected from a Dynasty Warriors game. They seem to just kind of update their engine as they go, and it's an old creaky engine. It's kind of disappointing because, yeah, like I would want to the Fire Emblem Warriors to run better than Hyrule Warriors has been running. You know, like it's good enough in co-op and split screen, but not in split screen, but like on the two screens on the Wii U. But you know, the Switch is more powerful. I would have hoped.
Yeah,
that
it kind of has option, doesn't it? You can sort of trade off fidelity for smoothness. That's actually something that's sort of a choice that's given to the player.
Right. And, you know, of course, just like Hyrule Warriors, it's going to be, it's going to support DLC and, hopefully they're going to update, not just the content of the game, but they're going to throw out a few patches to make it run more smoothly as they go. Fingers crossed, I guess. But yeah, I'm still not decided if I want to get the game like right now. I think I'm going to let myself kind of think about it and, also, I kind of hope that Nintendo just announces Hyrule Warriors for the Switch. That would be neat. Like, I think I would, despite, you know, the characters not being the main draw for us, like, I think I would still prefer to be playing a Zelda theme Dynasty Warriors.
It performed quite well when it came out. In terms of sales, not in terms of system performance. It performed quite poorly in that regard. But especially on the split screen, single player was all right, but I would expect that this is effectively the de facto sequel to that game, and I would assume that at some point, if this performs reasonably well, which it's up against the fact that Mario is coming out pretty soon thereafter, but if it performs reasonably well, then I would assume that's sort of the thing they would go back to, because I can't really think of another franchise that they could continue that partnership with. And as we've talked about, Nintendo establishes a partnership like this and just keeps going back to that well.
Hmm. And I kind of wonder if they're just going to wait until like the DLC for Breath of the Wild is out. And then, like, you know, they're going to announce Hyrule Warriors for Switch like 6 months after the last piece of DLC comes out. You know, just to have something to satiate the Zelda fans after Breath of the Wild is kind of done, and you know, before whenever the next game comes out.
Maybe I would say, I mean, these games kind of run on a year and a half cadence out of that studio, so maybe late next year they could have a new game. I doubt this late in the game though they'd port it, since they've already released a game on the platform. It'd be kind of like maybe late 2018 if the release schedule's real light. It's kind of like what we talked about with Xenoblade Chronicles X, where it's like, well, we got a hole, so port that thing over.
Right.
But I mean, certainly that seems like the most obvious candidate for them to make a 2-2. Should have worded that better. And with these licensed games, because a lot of the ones that they make are licensed now, they have no qualms against making sequels to licensed Warriors games and coming up with some dumb, ridiculous nonsense to justify that game's existence. So,
right.
At the very least, you will at some point, I'm confident saying, you will have the opportunity to play a Warriors game in the Zelda universe on your Switch.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. We'll see. Maybe, sooner than we think, I'm going to have impressions of Fire Emblem Warriors. I don't know.
Ooh.
Yeah, the other thing that we've been playing, we've been all over the place in terms of what we're playing, and part of that is because of me. Like, I just can't help myself, and I keep like going after whatever comes out, or like, I don't know, games are distracting. Anyway, so the SNES Classic, no sooner that I finished Super Metroid that I was just like, well, 21 games is actually not that many, and I'd rather be playing something else. And so I went ahead and I hacked the SNES Classic to be able to import more games into it. And I'm kind of an idiot when it comes to computers and to, you know, like, I'm not a programmer like you, James. I'm not, I don't know what, like, dumping is or whatever, but it sure is a term that came up a lot during the installation process or the hacking process for this SNES Classic. So it was a little bit nerve-wracking to you know, just like plug the SNES Classic to my computer and download this Hacksy software, which hacks the NES and SNES Classics, and to just kind of trust that this untrustworthy program, according to Windows, will actually not break anything and break the SNES Classic and have me like hunt for a second one. And because I can't read simple instructions, I ended up messing up several times. You know, like when you first launch the software and have it kind of hack into the SNES Classic, you're supposed to hold the reset button and then, you know, flip on the SNES Classic, and then you're supposed to release the reset button. I had not, you know, I managed to miss the release the reset button part, and so, you know, the progress bar would very quickly stop in the middle of what it was doing, and it was just like, yeah, there's a problem here, we're gonna stop. And, you know, when that happens and you don't know what you're doing, you're just like, oh crap, oh crap, oh crap, like, am I breaking my console here?
How do you actually get to the hardware? Like, what was there, is there an interface that you're able to plug into your computer? Like, what's the process here?
Well, if you plug the SNES Classic with the USB cable that it comes with for power, you know, mm-hmm. it's powered by USB. If you plug it into your computer, it's recognized as a peripheral. But of course, you it's not like you can't just like, yeah, okay, I'll open like a file manager and just go replace some files in there.
It's
weird, right? Yeah, it's so, almost
so
as
like,
if like...
They almost must have known people were going to hack this thing then. I mean,
well, they certainly knew. They certainly released the SNES Classic knowing that there was nothing preventing the people who,
but,
like, they didn't change anything. In fact, it's the software.
I mean, when they released the NES Classic, because, I mean, they could have very easily had the USB plug just go to the battery and just charge the battery and have no connection to the software whatsoever.
Remember, though, it was kind of like the NES Classic was supposedly, like, targeted at people that would be, like not very savvy about this sort of stuff,
yeah,
I guess. You know, that
they had to make the decision to wire the USB into the
enthusiast crowd or whatever. So I guess
think that the enthusiast crowd was even like the people who were buying R4s left and right for the DS and pirating
games.
No,
the R4 was everywhere.
Yeah, I don't think that, I don't know, like it just seems like Nintendo didn't really care.
No, that's what I mean.
They had to make the active decision to connect that USB port to the hardware, though, besides just as a charging mechanism. Like, they said, no, this cable needs to have USB access to the hardware.
Hmm.
Like they did this to some degree of deliberateness. So, like, they must have thought, oh, well, this is gonna get cracked. There's nothing we could do about that.
Right.
I wonder if they just said, like, well, here's a device, and worst case scenario, if it goes poorly on the market, people can just buy it.
In terms of forethought and kind of contingencies and stuff, like, apparently the notion that this would have an appeal even to Nintendo enthusiasts, like, didn't really enter their head with the NES Classic. So they didn't really think about it a lot. That's why you ended up with such a paltry number of the units out there, because they, you know, I don't think there was enough. If there'd been more serious kind of scenario mapping or whatever, I think they may have come to the conclusion, yeah, we could probably sell more of these.
Oh, I mean, that came down to retailers looking at their Atari flashbacks and their...
Yeah, maybe so, but I mean, you know, to be fair, one could look at that information for what it's worth, you know, if you really looked at it, but I don't think they did. I mean, there was some interviews recently that was dealing with the issues like NES Classic and all that, and it does just seem like it was a very kind of hurried... thing in every sense, maybe probably because of, you know, the Wii U's woes and having something on shelves in that particular calendar window. You know, there's all the, like, they only added box art to the interface like really late, you know, like then they just, oh, we'll go with all the title screens. Oh, wait, they all look really similar. Let's do boxes instead. You know what I mean? It sounds like it was a bit of a slapdash thing. So I don't know how much they considered the ramifications of the USB thing. Because they didn't consider the ramifications of very much.
Like, I mean, that would have been like the very first thing any kind of like product would have been like, hey, maybe we should not connect this to the hardware directly. Just use it for charging. But I mean, there is something really surreal about the fact they said, that's fine, let's just do it again.
Yeah, and also the fact that this is like, they had forewarning, you know, like this is their second time, their second go at it, and they didn't change anything. And like, it's basically, I think, the same hardware in the NES and SNES Classic. So
yeah, that's probably why they probably just didn't want to, you know. Again, I mean, it seems like the demand for the NES Classic kind of caught them off guard, and we've got the Super Nintendo iteration this year. NES Classic is getting a reprint next year. You know, it just kind of seems like, okay, well, let's like turn that around and get the sales we can out of it, kind of thing, rather than like, oh, let's go back to the drawing board and, you know, correct things like that.
Yeah. So mostly, yeah, I still got scruples. I mostly downloaded games that I have the card for or that I bought on the various virtual consoles, sometimes more than once. So, you know, like that's how I can live with myself after doing what I've done.
I think could you like use it as like a shrine to your purchasing habits? Or like, if you've literally bought something three times, it's like on there three times, like three icons. You know what? I have bought this too many times. I need this as a reminder to myself. Like, let's exercise discipline in the future.
Yeah, the PlayerOne podcast often jokes about kind of just buying an NES Classic or SNES Classic, filling it with like 200 files of Home Alone 2, and then returning to the store so that the next person, you know, buys that thing is just like, what the hell?
That's like a war crime.
Yeah, that's a lot worse than a lump of coal. Let's put it that way.
So the thing is, there's... Yeah, and someone on Twitter, I can't remember who, unfortunately, warned me. Like, they said, don't you know, install more than like a dozen games or something, because otherwise you're not going to play any of them. And in fact, yeah, like I installed a bunch of stuff, and then I kind of didn't really touch it. And some of the stuff that I did install wasn't really working well anyway. Like Uniracers doesn't work with the kind of built-in emulator that's on that thing. Goof Troops doesn't work. So yeah, and Illusion of Gaia is a game, like an RPG that I keep not playing despite having a cart from a flea market like 10 years ago, and that doesn't work either. So the thing is, though, there's a ton of space on that thing. I installed like some of the beefiest Super Nintendo games that you can install, and of course there are small files, but still, like I installed maybe like 50 games, and I think I used up like 30 megs out of 200. So you can install a lot of things on there, and you can install other emulators. So there's that. I could just download like RetroArch, I think it's called, and just use that to run the games that are not really compatible with the built-in emulator. And some of
Pretty
the other
Free
games...
Nintendo does not condone piracy. Just putting that out there.
Yeah.
So we don't get a letter.
Well, you probably will, but
you don't want them bloody revoking the review copies, James Christ.
That's right. Yeah, the review copies they've already revoked.
So Yeah, and Karen and I played kind of a quote-unquote selection of two-player co-op games. They were not very carefully selected. It was basically me going to a ROM depository and you know, filtering by two-player simultaneous and downloading everything. And we did not really stick with any of those games. Rival Turf was one of the games that we played.
This is the Jellico.
Yeah,
the final fight knockoff, and it was it was, you know, it stars the dude who kicks and the big beefy guy with the wrestling moves, that says it all. And we also played Pocky and Rocky,
okay,
which
progress,
but no Becky is what you're saying.
No Becky, with Becky, and we just found it a little bit too hard for us, or at least I don't know. Like the game is super fast paced, and you just like run to your death very quickly without knowing it.
I think you're on a timer there too, right? Like the levels. Not only are you rushing through it, but you're on a timer. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah, there is a timer. There is a timer in that game.
Yeah. See, I pretty much hate games with timers. Like, I don't like being pressured to run through a game.
Yeah. So it hasn't been great. And also, like, the game is kind of lacking some niceties, like being able to stand still and aim and shoot everywhere. you know, like, you have to be walking forward or towards where you're shooting. And usually that's towards, like, the enemy. And I don't know. It didn't really... didn't really impress us that much. And then
it was super cute, but it wasn't it wasn't fun to play.
Yeah. So we switched to Hyrule Warriors and we never looked back. And that's basically what I played this week. I installed the Synchronicity Prologue, the Shin Megami Tensei kind of Metroidvania that Atlus released in Japan. And I installed a translation patch that someone made. So I'm taking a lot of risks here for RFN, just risking breaking my system and, you know, installing viruses and stuff on my computer. But I only played a little bit of that, and it seemed it sure looks and sounds like a Castlevania game. It's a pretty big ripoff, but it does some good, you know, some cool things. Like you start out as a I don't know the actual names of these guys, the Jack brothers.
Yeah.
Snowjack, maybe the ice guy, Jack Frost shoots some icicles, and when you shoot icicles in water, it turns into ice, so it solidifies it as a platform, and so you can walk on it. And I unlocked Jack Lantern, I suppose, the fire guy. And the opposite happens. It can melt.
Jack actually is his name.
Pyro Jack. It's been a while. So he can melt ice walls, and you can, open new paths that way. And he also floats around, so you open a lot of new paths. And it's pretty cool. So I encourage people to check that out.
Cool. Greg.
Yep. Something I actually started playing a while ago. It was kind of intended as my sort of palate cleanser between Metroid-y games, between Samus Returns and SteamWorld Dig. And I did play it a fair bit then, but I sort of went back, ended up kind of rushing into Dig 2, and then came back to this. This is Cursed Castilla EX for the 3DS. So this is a kind of a retail, digital kind of for purchase version of a freeware game from 2012, made by someone who goes under the name of Loco Melito. Back then it was known as Maldita Castilla. It's very much in the Ghosts and Goblins vein, which might give you an idea of why I went for this, because I do very much enjoy those games. And kind of go back to Guillaume saying about that Shin Megami Tensei kind of Castlevania thing being a ripoff. You say ripoff, I say someone's got to make it right.
I was going to make that joke.
And we're in a similar place.
with and none of us are going to get in the credits of a game now.
I know. It's just not fair, is it? But it's a similar thing with Ghosts and Goblins. You know, it's not something that Capcom's going to do a great deal with these days. Although, we did just see like the Switch version of Resident Evil Revelations 2 has a sort of ROM hack style reskin of Ghosts and Goblins with Barry running around in his undies throwing knives.
Yeah, it's really weird. And also, like, the music from the trailer I've seen seems like a serious downgrade. Ghosts and Goblins has such great music, and then like, I don't know, whatever they replaced it with is not so great.
Well, so I have no idea how much of the original Ghosts and Goblins is that. Clearly the video shows a reskin of the first level of the original Ghosts and Goblins. I'm not sure how much more, how much deeper it goes or whatever, but it is nice to see them sort of acknowledge the series with stuff like that. But in this case with Cursed Castillo, I kind of came to my attention really when I think it was we had a review up on the site that was very complimentary, that Perry, who writes intro music and does the Talk Nintendo podcast and all that, reviewed it, liked it a lot. So I thought this sounds like something I could get into. But then I didn't actually buy it for a while, and then it was on sale, a very modest reduction. It wasn't a big time, and to be honest, I wasn't waiting for a sale or anything. But, you know, to kind of go back to what's happening on Switch with them finally putting a section for like stuff that's on sale.
It's not just a section for stuff that's new, though.
Yeah, sometimes the sale part is more helpful just for like reminding you that this game exists and that you might like to play it. If it's already been out for a while, rather than just now it's under price X. I actually think it's worth it. Because there's a lot of stuff in this kind of vein these days, especially with Switch now. It's getting really busy, but this is on 3DS, and it just kind of reminded me. I do want to get that. I want to see, how well it kind of compares with the Ghosts and Goblins series. So, I got into it, and it's a pretty good take on the formula. It's got a few kind of concessions, if you like, to modernity, trying to be a bit more forgiving. You could take three hits. You don't end up running around in your undies at any point. It didn't quite go that far. Was it Battle Princess Madeline? Like, that seems like it's going to be even more kind of brazen.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Although, like, this has a more kind of authentic, like, it very much looks like a sort of mid to late 80s arcade game. And sounds exactly like it, because it uses the same kind of music, FM synth, composition hardware, all that stuff. It's totally off it, whereas Madeline looks more kind of flashy. But in terms of like the animations and all that kind of stuff, I mean, it's they're practically using tracing paper over those on sprites, I think. But with this, it's still, it's pretty damn close, but it may be not quite that close. There's certain enemies like there's big fat guys in black hoods, like executioners walking around, which are very clearly standing in for the sort of big ogres that are in some of the early levels of Ghosts and Goblins. Yeah, so there's some very direct stuff, but it's not like too on the nose, I guess. But in general, it's very, very similar mechanically. Most similar, it should be said, to Ghouls and Ghosts, the middle game. So to be clear, Ghosts and Goblins is the first, then Ghouls and Ghosts, then Super Ghouls and Ghosts is a separate game. It is not just like the Super Nintendo version. It's a sequel, and quite different mechanically, because what Ghouls and Ghosts did that this does is have four directional shooting. So, you can shoot straight up and you can shoot down when you're jumping, which is something you couldn't do in Ghosts and Goblins. And it's also something you couldn't do in Super Ghouls and Ghosts. With Super Ghouls and Ghosts, they took that away, but they added the double jump. So those two games end up with quite a different kind of flavor. And this is on the Ghouls and Ghosts side of that divide. Although there is like a power up that you can get that gives you the double jump. But, you know, the levels aren't designed around it in the main, and certainly, you know, it's an item that you can lose, that you might choose to get a different one because, you know, there's other items that are helpful, you could take an extra hit with a shield, or you can have a sort of little fairy kind of do extra damage and things like that. And sometimes you actually need to sort of set aside your item for a key that you need to progress, so you could never, even if you wanted to, you could never take the double jump all the way through the game. So, you know, it's in the main, it's very authentic, but it does kind of, like I said, help you along a little bit if maybe it was, you know, the unforgivingness of the original Makaimura games was too much for you. There's a little bit of control over the jumps in the air. Certainly not like comprehensive, but it's not nil. There's that. But you know, I don't think those kinds of concessions and stuff is really enough to get somebody that's been put off by the Ghosts and Goblins games to now say, "Oh, this is, you know, the same thing but more approachable, and I might like it." Probably not. I mean, obviously, I can't speak for those people because I'm not one of them. I like Ghosts and Goblins and Ghouls and Ghosts a great deal, but I'm just projecting. You know, I think it's still pretty much for people who love those games, and it's just they've kind of taken some of the mechanical rough edges out a little bit. And, you know, what you end up with is also, you know, plenty of enemies on screen at once and all that. It feels a little bit more dynamic than, certainly than the original Ghosts and Goblins, but even compared to something like Ghouls and Ghosts. And brings in a lot of kind of level design, sort of broad concepts that you would have seen in those games, like where it's almost like a quasi shooter because you're kind of on a scrolling kind of section. In this case, like for instance, you're in a kind of horse-drawn cart and a bunch of enemies are attacking you. And they're like more vertical oriented sections and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's all very kind of reminiscent of those games, but you know, all with a careful eye. Like I would say that the weapons are better balanced than they were in those games, because you know, for me, something in Super Ghouls and Ghosts, for instance, like the dagger is just so much better than the lance that you normally have, you know, because it's pretty much the same but just quicker, you know. So why wouldn't you want that? But with this, they sort of take a different approach in terms of anytime you destroy something and a weapon becomes available to pick, you get a chest and the weapon thing comes out, then it will be a sort of rotating icon. So it'll cycle through all the different weapons and you just pick the one you want. Now, sometimes if you're in a hurry, maybe I'll accidentally end up kind of going through it straight away or something. But, you know, in the main, you've got control over which weapon you want. But it's not like in Super Ghouls and Ghosts, where it's like, if you get the lantern, you're like, oh God, please just kill me. Like, I'll kill myself, you know, like, these all seem a bit better tuned to have. So, I mean, I've got my favourite is the sickle, you know, so it's got a sort of very rapid fire component to it, not unlike the dagger in those old games. But in this case, that is balanced out by the fact that the range is not as good. So there are some contexts where it's like, yeah, actually, I'd rather have the default weapon here, you know. And if you have learned the game, you can actually kind of prepare for that eventuality as well. And it wouldn't be too long before you'd have the chance to switch back. So, yeah, you know, it's pretty well done in most respects. They sort of take on the whole two loops thing is interesting. It's much more of a kind of Castlevania notion of like the bad ending, you know, like, so think like Symphony of the Night, you know, like in this case it's like, well, you go through it once and chances are you're not going to find all the things to kind of unlock the real ending, and so you have some sense of finality, but then it's like, okay, well, that was clearly not optimal for the outcome of the kingdom or whatever. So I'm assuming there's something I could do. And it turns out there's like five secret things to unlock, like what is quite a substantial sort of end game. It's not just like a final boss or anything. You have actually got, you know, significant level content to go with that. But you know, I'll confess, for me, I could find three of the five by myself with a few playthroughs, and after that, I was like, I'm gonna have to look them up, because it's just not, you know, I don't know how many, you know, this is not a Metroid style game or something where it's free exploration. You know, you are going through levels in order, and I just don't know how many, you know, more times I could do that and feel like you're getting closer to finding it or anything. I mean, you're on a timer for that matter as well, which is quite tight sometimes. Although you can find extra time and whatnot, but you know, so it just kind of felt like, okay, let's, you know, if I'm going to enjoy the end game, I've made a pretty good effort at it to try and find them by myself. Fair most of them, but let's have a look. And I don't think I was going to be finding them, to be honest. They're pretty obscure. One of them is like some graveyard duck shit. I'm not kidding. I mean,
like, was it, like, does it give you hints on how to find this stuff, or is it just like, no, you'll figure it out?
Yeah, I not as far as I'm aware. I don't know if there's anything like, you know, there are things like the codex, like that, where you kind of logs like enemies and things, and there's some achievements that might give you hints about, like, okay, there's things you can do in the game that might be worth doing, that, you know, when you play it once, you're like, I didn't see that, or where was that, or whatever. But no, certainly nothing that would have led me to where these were, but I'm glad I looked it up and did it, because then I had the opportunity to see the end game, which is really quite cool. You know, some of the most challenging stuff, as you'd expect, a cool last boss, you know, just the kind of finale that a game like this you know, should have. And all in all, it's pretty substantial, you know, for a game of this type. Lot of bosses to fight as well. You get a mid boss as well as the end of level boss that you'd expect. You know, and the number of stages is pretty long as well. So yeah, if you are into this kind of thing, this is a damn good kind of exponent of that style, you know, and pretty authentic. And this 3DS conversion is, you know, cool, because it does have the stereoscopic 3D effect on the pixel art, which is generally, you know, well done. There's a few odd cases where it's like they've put an enemy in the background, which, you know, but then you can still kill it. You know, it kind of looks like you shouldn't be able to shoot it because they've put it in the background, but you can. But in the main, it just helps the graphics pop, look really nice, give that sense of scale to it that goes well with the pixel art. And they've got this sort of cute little interface with the lower screen. Is it kind of the lower screen together with the top screen gives the impression of playing it on an arcade cabinet. And on the lower screen, the actual arcade cabinet sort of artifice, you have like a little panel that you can open and dip switches to play with to change the settings. And you can put coins in to kind of give yourself what they call arcade mode, where you've just got four credits because there's four coins on top of the machine. And that's like that's an achievement to shoot for, is being able to do it in four continues, which to this point I have not been able to do, which I think is like you need to do that to get the actual best ending. Even though I've kind of got the not bad ending, I guess, at this juncture. But no, I really, really enjoyed this. You know, I totally recommend reading the review on the site as well if you want to kind of look at it there. You know, another take on it. But, you know, for whatever subtle kind of and clever kind of things that it does to, you know, maybe bring things up to date a little bit, this is for fans of that kind of game, of the Ghosts and Goblins, no doubt about it. So you probably, you know, so the NES Classic has brought out the people that hate Ghouls and Ghosts again. You know, the snide, you know, 20 good games and Ghouls and Ghosts type of thing is out there. So chances are, you know, if you're one of those people, you know, you already know to stay well away from this. But, you know, I do think, you know, there's some of the things they do with, like, having a carry the key, right, and find it, which can sometimes late in the game is necessary, but earlier on it tends to be for finding some of these extra collectibles that open up the true ending. And that is actually something that reminds me of Castlevania Rebirth. So it's not all right. You know, there's some stuff, like I said, that's a bit Castlevania-y in here somewhere, you know, with some things, but it's mostly, you know, especially mechanically, Ghosts and Goblins, so you know what you're in for.
I mean, even visually, like, it's giving you all the red flags.
Yeah, there are some very Red Arima looking baddies as well, but they don't have that same absolutely infuriating attack pattern, mercifully.
This game, like, I was aware of it when it came out on the PC, but kind of totally missed it, I guess is probably the way of putting it. Like, I forgot that it was there, and so I forgot that it came out on 3DS, and now I'm kind of into this because, you know, I actually do really like Ghosts and Goblins, although obviously I'm more of my experience is more in the super realm, so this is going to be a little
like
bit different.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, it is more in the, for people who are kind of, familiar enough to know the difference, there is a pretty significant distinction with super, because that double jump thing kind of makes it more of a platformer, and I think that drives some people even more up the wall, because it's, you know, like, because of the way the platforming works. But yeah, this is more of a, you know, sort of the action component of it. You know, there's a little bit of platforming they kind of work in there with it, but it's more in the ghosts, the Ghouls and Ghosts action sort of strain of the series.
Cool. All right. Well, I guess I'll go ahead and close this out today. I haven't been playing a lot of new stuff because, of course, about 2 hours before the show started last week, I got Latent Mystery Journey, Catriel, and the Millionaire's Conspiracy. I've learned the whole name of the game now.
Nice. I will congratulate you on that. You keep fishing for, you know, like, oh, I got the episode title right, like, you know, or number right. Like, please,
You can't even get your slam in correctly. Jeez,
I know,
come on.
I know. That, so you, I really, like, messed that up.
Yeah, like, there's a certain beautiful synchronicity to you going and going, like, you
got it.
And then,
I can
and then
always
actually managing to
post.
Managing to blow up your entire slam. That's impressive. Like, that's just
anyway,
next level.
I am impressed. Like, I would never bother to remember that title.
That title is too much. Like, that title is absolutely too much. But, so I have, and it's not even like the situation where they are in, where, like, the title in Europe and the title in North America for these games could not be more different, which is a standard for the series. This is just straight up, like, the title is what the title is. But I have gotten pretty far into the game at this point. So when we talked last time, there was one, I had completed one of the mysteries, the so-called mysteries. Because what this game really is it's supposed to being one big, and I talked about this last week, but it's supposed to being one big story. It's like a bunch of small stories, like a bunch of small quests. These like miniature mysteries that Catriel and her latent detective service is hired to solve. And you know, they run about an hour and a half or so. So like I've cleared six, I think, and I've got about 11 hours clocked. So it's not, you know, it's not taking up a bunch of time. I'm through five. So like you play the first four, and each one unlocks the next one, and then you get four of them just dumped on you, and you can just pick any of the four, and you have to clear all those, and then you unlock kind of the end game, where they attempt to tie these narratively unrelated things together, apparently. I was not feeling very good about this game last week, and I've already said something that longtime fans of the show have heard and know my review, because I said I haven't beaten it yet. And people who listened to the show for a while know that when I get these things, it turns into a very quick, like, rundown where I just beat the game in about, I don't know, a day, 2 days. Like an unhealthy speed is applied to completing these games. And a quest for completeness that's just not reasonable or healthy. I'm still applying that desire to burn through this game and to complete all the puzzles and stuff, even though the puzzles aren't particularly good. and an exactness in doing it. But, like, I haven't actually really enjoyed my time with this game, which is why it's not been beaten. Like, I'll play it for half an hour, and I'm like, yeah, I'm done. And a lot of the stuff I talked about last time, you know, I don't care for any of the characters. There's no overarching mystery that's like, man, I wonder where they're going to take this thing. The scale of everything is very, very small. The puzzles really aren't that mentally rewarding. A lot of them are just, there is a startling number of slide shit around on the screen puzzles, which is always the weak part of this series. There's a bunch of just like really basic wordplay and like, did you really read it questions in play. You know, there's one where I'll actually read it. You know what? I will read this puzzle to you because it's not, I want to see, like, you don't have to read it that hard. And this gives you an idea of what this game is, because there's a lot of this. You visit the castle to show the king the 5 treasure chests you collected on your adventures. However, each castle regulation state that each visitor may only carry 1 item of luggage. You are here with 1 companion, and it's a 3-minute walk from where you are to where the king is located. How many minutes will it take to show the king all of the treasure chests? 1 chest counts as 1 item of luggage. This one's really simple. No guesses?
Okay.
It's 6 minutes. You go get the king. And you show him all the treasure chests that way. But like that's like the kind of puzzles we're dealing with here. And those were always in the Layton series, but it's a lot of those.
Right. Eventually you just say, okay, what's the catch?
You just look for those. There have been 2 distinct puzzles where basically the answer was like you're in a car and all your possessions are in the car and you're following a lorry because there's only 1 localization this time. And it's got all the rest of your stuff in it. This lorry can hold infinite weight, but you can't. And you're running out of fuel. You have to follow it across town. And then it gives you a bunch of math stuff about like how much your junk is affecting the fuel economy of your car. How many gallons of gas do you need to get across town and follow the truck? And the answer is 0 because, of course, right, it told you the infinite capacity of the truck. Which is literally, I saw that word and went up 0.
Right.
There are multiple puzzles that are basically variations on that theme. So 69 puzzles in. Yeah, I have cleared every single puzzle in all of the quests I've done. And I have every single hint coin. Note, not found, have, because I haven't used a single hint coin yet. In 69 puzzles. That's not good. Like, I like these games for the puzzles and for the story, and I'm getting neither of these things. So, this is really kind of a bummer. And, like, I was prepared, but at the same time, like, this slog is such a bummer. Honestly, if you're a fan of this series, I don't know that I can recommend it to you, because you're dealing with everything is subpar compared to the worst entries in the late series. Even the scale of the so-called mysteries are outrageously tiny. To the point where one of them is basically like Boo Haunted House. Well, it's a haunted house. Okay, like I had a different game where an entire village was, I don't know if I want to spoil that game because they may remake it, but like the scope you're dealing with, even on its smallest scale of that series, is a million times bigger than this. And so it's kind of like, all right, well, I don't care about the mysteries and I already know what's going on because immediately it became apparent. And the characters are still flailing around like ghosts. I guess we'll just keep going through it. But yeah, like I'll probably finish it in the next week or so before Mario comes out. Because like I said, it doesn't take long to do these things. It's an hour and a half and I've completely cleared an hour and a half and I've cleared a mystery and found all the hint coins and found all the puzzles and solved all the puzzles. And I think there's like between 10 and 12. I'm about through half of them. So, you know, I can half pay attention to playing it. But the fact that I'm just drilling through the story and barely reading the dialogue now in a game series where the dumb dialogue and the ridiculous plot was like part of its big appeal is really disappointing. And the charm's just not there. It seems like everybody phoned it in on this game. Even the music, like, yeah, Nishir is still a great composer, but man, he basically just pulled out his old compositions for the Leighton series and said, I don't know, use these again. I don't care. It's a bummer. It's a real bummer. But yeah, sorry to end New Business on a downer. That's probably the most disappointed I've sounded in a game on the show in a while. But it is what it is. So that will do it for New Business. Karen, you put,
I'm probably gonna go.
Okay, that's what I wanted. I forgot to ask where we started.
No, that's fine. Thanks for having me on. It was great.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
You're welcome back anytime.
Well, I'm gonna be talking about Yoshi's Island at some point, so look forward to that.
Woo-hoo.
Great.
Woohoo!
All right. Well, that is going to do it. We'll be back after the break with listener mail. We're back. It's time for listener mail. You can send your listener mail to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I guess that's technically three words, even though Nintendo World Report's really three words itself, but that's okay. Much like these people did, Guillaume, would you please read the first email?
Adrian writes, I was hoping you guys could speak about the arcade's influence on console game design. Arcade games are often dismissed for their difficulty, but there are other things about them that helped shape console gaming. For example, in the early noughties, oh god, I've never seen that word before.
Yeah, that's something that started happening around 2010. It's bad.
Many of Sega's console-only games were greatly informed by arcade game design. Jet Set Radio, Space Channel 5, Rez, etc. I also think the Tony Hawk Pro Skater series took a lot of inspiration from arcade games before going quote-unquote open world in THPS4. For me, arcade-style games are defined by their accessibility, quick burst gameplay, sometimes with a timer, and score attack modes. Would you like to see a revival of any of these features in games today? I find many games today are over-reliant on progress meters and RPG mechanics to incentivize players to continue. Sorry.
I think there's no denying the very profound effect on, you know, early the console games, you know, especially, you know, when you think about stuff on NES and Famicom, a lot of the biggest publishers, you know, outside of Nintendo themselves, who also had their own background in arcades, kind of we touched on last week, but, you know, they were, you know, pretty big successes in the arcade scene, and then, you know, the biggest sort of ticket items they had were, you know, ports of those games. But even moving beyond that, you know, the design paradigm often kind of held a lot of consistency with an arcade game, even though that wasn't, you know, the imperative was no longer there if it was something that was designed specifically for the home. Just the fact that, you know, those were the kinds of games that they were used to making, that they thought players wanted an arcade. You know, that was like the appeal of a console to some extent, was the fact that you were going to play, you know, arcade style experiences in your own home and as much as you liked, you know, kind of thing. So it had a very profound effect on the console games early on. And yeah, it even kind of, you know, that persisted to some extent even going into, you know, much, much later generations, like Adrian talks about in the, you know, the first early part of this century. Especially with somebody like Sega, because they had an extremely, you know, rich kind of background in arcade games. But
also, they didn't get out the same way Nintendo did either.
No,
Nintendo
exactly.
Didn't totally get out, but Sega kept that whole division going. And in fact, Sega's lead designers, the people that you think of with Sega, were arcade first. Miyamoto was arcade first, but mostly as a contrivance of the fact he was an artist and Nintendo didn't own a console yet. Sega had people who like said, we want to put a bike that you actually ride, because I mean that's the ultimate arcade experience. It's a big bulky piece of plastic that you ride on. It's not so much that the game is great. It's that you have an experience you can't have elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And Guitar Hero, actually. DDR coming into homes. Like, that kind of stuff. The plastic crap era of gaming. All kind of stems out of that arcade experience where it wasn't... It would not have been at all weird to walk up to an arcade game and play on a virtual drum kit or a virtual guitar, or to belt out lyrics into it.
And of course, I mean, like, you know, in the 80s, of course, you had cabinets like that. They think of some of the big Sega ones, like Afterburner, Super right. Hang On, you know, they had that. But I think as it went on, I guess the sort of onus was more and more on arcade games to give you something you couldn't have at home, or that would be kind of onerously kind of expensive or whatever, to have at home. So that the arcade games went even further in that direction, whereas earlier on in the sort of home console era, they could trade more off, like, oh, well, these graphics are still way ahead of what you could do on NES and all that. So their flashiness was kind of enough.
Yeah.
But the experience part was always there, and it kind of got amped up as arcade games kind of struggled to retain their relevance as the console market matured.
Well, so like Yu Suzuki, who's the person I was mostly referring to there, and his AM2 mm-hmm. team, like, they were all about that. Like, that was their driving feature, which is like, let's give you something you can't see somewhere else. And that's why you ended up with some really crazy hardware. I mean, there were versions of, I don't remember which Afterburner it was, where the whole damn thing moved.
Yeah, it was a cockpit, scenario.
It was kind of nuts. And these games continued to influence Sega pretty deep in. I mean, even when you start thinking about, like, what games they came out with, good old Wise from Your Guabe is pretty much an arcade game.
And again, like, to talk about the effect that it had on the home stuff. Yeah, but they didn't have Sonic to begin with. Beast was the game that was used to sell the Genesis in North America, and the real premise of that was not so much the game itself really, as it was this is an arcade style and quality experience in your home. Clearly that's also going to feed into. Not just like the look of the games that you're looking to kind of get people in with, but the design sort of philosophies behind them as well.
Yeah, and like it doesn't look like much today, but Altered Beast, as I described last week, that was the game that I said was my first Nintendo memory. It was that striking, so much that when I think of one of my first early Nintendo memories is going to my friend's house and like he and his sister are all excited because they rented this thing and like Altered Beast is playing on the TV and I had never seen anything like it, right? But then, as you said, Sonic, they didn't have it at the beginning. So they didn't have kind of console design style console games on their machine initially.
So Sega in particular, and we talk about them a lot because they kind of retained the arcadiness.
No, and that was probably the biggest draw. Once they kind of clamped down on, people doing versions of their games on other hardware, they kind of exercised this exclusivity.
Right.
Home platforms were the place to play the best, good versions of their arcade games. But they also set about looking at converting other people's, best arcade stuff, and using that to kind of flesh out the lineup and stuff. Ghouls and Ghosts for the Genesis is another good example of that. That Sega, I think, ported that themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They licensed that from Capcom, and again to say. The Genesis or the Mega Drive, wherever you were in the world, this is where you play, the best ports of arcade stuff. So it was, as well as the fact that they were steeped in it, that was the whole angle of the system at first. Over time, it would evolve. You know, we had Sonic, we had, you know, sports games in particular was a big plank of its appeal as it would, as time would go on. But that was kind of how they got their foot in the door, was that connection to the arcade.
And there's go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Well, Adrian writes about like the arcade game design being dismissed because of the difficulty. And I don't think that it's necessarily the difficulty as much as it is the unfairness, right? Like there
are
design...
it's the ways in which it's difficult at times, and that, and it's there's I think, you know, Adrian kind of encapsulates it pretty well in the email here in terms of, you know, dismissed for the difficulty, like I think, yeah, more precisely might be the unfairness, the quarter munching, we call it, you know, because it's just like, okay, well, you know, we're going to hit the player with things that they it's an arcade game, they don't own it, they have no reasonable expectation that they could foresee some of this stuff, and there's, oh shit, you know, and then there's, oh no, I'll just put in another, you know, another credit.
Even things like in Gauntlet, where your health just goes down anyway.
Yeah, the timer component.
Like, you are playing perfectly, but we don't care.
Yeah, still, I mean, look, it's a real concern in terms of, you know, you do need to kind of... What you do want to kind of have it be that, you know, like it's not just like the same person just hogging the machine that like happens to be
on a quarter.
Yeah, exactly. That's not acceptable. So I get it. Yeah, there was an imperative there in the arcades. You know, I still think certain arcade games kind of balance those objectives better than others, for sure. You know, there was still a good and a sort of poor way to handle that that you saw. But also, you know, it talks about the accessibility and the quick burst gameplay. Now, that is also an imperative in the arcade. That, you know, that you haven't got time for people's like, oh god, this is like super complex, I've got to acclimate myself to this and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's got to, first of all, it's got to draw them in somehow, and that's usually going to be with the graphics. It could also be with sound, you know, like
loud
speech
noises
being really loud or a theme song or whatever, you know, all that. But then once you get someone to have a go, it's got to grab them very quickly. You know, if they're actually as okay, no, you know, I've got as far as I've got on one credit, I don't really need to put another one in. And that's that, like I said, that imperative, you know, is kind of was something that really kind of disciplined developers, I think, in terms of like, yeah, you know, we've got to make this something that grabs you straight away. And it's true, you know, as time went on, and obviously the people, you know, pushed the boundaries with home consoles, you know, seeing the fact that, hey, this is a different kind of experience at home, we can go deeper with it and all that. The kind of the sad fact about that in some cases was that you would get these kind of ponderous openings and tutorials and all this stuff, and, you know, controllers with shitloads of buttons and triggers and all this kind of stuff, and it wasn't as accessible or immediate anymore.
Right. So, I mean, to give some context here, so until even the Famicom, really, the idea of there was, of course, up to the video game crash, there were systems, not all of them, the 2600, the Intellivision, the ColecoVision less, that were dedicated game devices. But in general, home video game systems were not video game systems. They were home computers or microcomputers, depending on what terminology was being used for that thing, that played games. And the games were core to the identity of those devices, you know, your Commodores, even like the Famicom in Japan, like they marketed it as a home computer. It's in the name, because releasing a dedicated video game device was still somewhat like, well, I don't know if we can do this again. Atari went on a run of dumping these things into the marketplace. So just like, here's another home computer. Here's another one. And so the games that were made on that were either like these really keyboard intensive things that didn't really adapt to a gamepad, or they were hasty ports of arcade games because that was the only other games that were being made. And so when this sort of dedicated video game device market started going, I mean, you could argue that a lot of the home computers were basically dedicated for that. but like actual, like this is a video game. Stuff that came out of the home computer space didn't really make the transition over because it wasn't suited. And so the people who had experience making games who could adapt were the arcades. And so those early generations, you know, like the Famicom, the SG-1000, what's the other one? There was another one that came out roughly around the same time. The only games on those were effectively arcade games because those were the only games that were being made that could be played on them without the benefit of something like a keyboard. And so those people became the core developers at the companies making games. And as they transitioned over, it just took a long time to learn that new system. And I think a big reason why we saw those go away is just that the audience started to demand an experience that's less like I'm going to see the same stage every, you know, I mean, you could even argue that the original Super Mario Brothers, it's whole like, okay, how far can you get? And how it distributes secrets and how it basically challenges you to get with a fixed number of lives has a certain arcadeness to it.
Oh, yeah. No. Even then it was still, whereas of course one of the most remarkable things about Super Mario Brothers in its day was how much it kind of seemed incredibly expansive compared to arcade games.
Right.
And the secrets and all that kind of stuff. There was still, you know, some of that sort of sensibility about it, yeah, you know, with the way it handled lives and progress and all that kind of thing. Even though it's a home game, you know what I mean? No one, you know, needs to pay to continue here. They've already paid. But
right.
Right. But and that's the thing with arcade adaptations. Like, so in Super Mario Brothers' case, I think the arcade version came a little bit later.
The versus arcade, yeah.
Right.
We are going to get on Switch. Yeah, we are.
But they removed, you know, some of the hidden one-ups, and they certainly made some of the stages harder. It's kind of a, you know, halfway between Super Mario Brothers on the NES and the Lost Levels, the sequel that they got in Japan. But the problem is just taking like the pure arcade experience and transposing it to console. Usually, like you have to do so much tweaking to make it satisfying. Sorry, I'm just going to use the example of beat 'em ups again. When Konami finally brought like the Simpsons arcade game and the X-Men arcade game to PSN and Xbox, they did not change the balance. They didn't balance the game. They didn't make it more fair than in, you know, like it was still the kind of the quarter muncher that those games were. Yeah. And so you've got like, as a result, it was bad in the arcades, but it's even more infuriating at home. In the X-Men game, when you use your powers, that uses up your health and there's no health regaining item. And so you just die very, very quickly. You have to, you know, put another quarter in or, you know, use a credit to continue on the home version. And you've got an infinite number of them in the home version, the conversion. And it's just, so you get through the game and it's just like, it's not that satisfying. And,
no, especially like I said, we talked about the sort of distinction with brawlers before about what the others was that have, and this applies to like shoot 'em ups and other arcade dominated genres. Yeah, where you kind of had checkpoints, you know, like those tended to work better at home, whereas the ones where it was just like trying to kill you all the time, and you know, you could just if you kept paying money, you could just continue right where you were. Mm-hmm. Though those didn't really translate that well because it's just it sort of becomes this slog of just like, well, you know, I'll just keep putting in my virtual quarters and until I beat it, you know. It can be very unsatisfying as a home experience.
Yeah, but at least, you know, like some developers had kind of a better touch converting their arcade games to home consoles. Like the Final Fight series, In the arcade, it's pretty much a quarter muncher. I did not talk about it in the podcast, but after Karen and I went through Final Fight 3, Final Fight 2, and had a pretty good time playing them and kind of beat those games on the hardest difficulty, and, you know, like, it was a challenge, but we did it, and it seemed fair, I did download for MAME the arcade version of Final Fight 1 so that we could play it together. And it's not enjoyable at all. Like, very quickly, like, you know, we each grabbed a controller, we started the game, we started beating up bad guys, and like, oh, wait, already went through our two lives. Okay, let me go put another credit. Oh, yeah. And like the, so we were playing on TV, the laptop was connected to the TV, and it was sitting on the ground. And so like, okay, so I get up, I go press 1 and 2 to insert more quarters. We resume, and then we're dead again. So, you know, very quickly, I was just sitting on the
floor.
You
should map that to a button on the controller.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess that's
it would
kind
be worth
of
it.
Trying to simulate the inconvenience of using currency.
Right, yeah. Right. Oh, let me run to the change machine. I've only got,
got 10 seconds. Yeah.
Otherwise, that dynamite's going to blow up, damn it.
That's right. The other, I mean, the things that the arcade gameplay really speaks to, and one of them, you know, is the idea of they wanted to create a spectacle. So like a versus component was super important. The ability to play against someone who's there, either in direct combat or in score attack, and usually with some degree of consequence. You know, the other person got to keep going, so it creates the challenge. Now, obviously, to getting to the question of what do we want to see with respect to a revival of arcade games, or you know, not revival is not the right word, but continuation of. I mean, fighting games continue to this day, and in fact are arguably in some kind of a renaissance right now, and they are the ultimate arcade game. I mean, I vividly remember as a child going into arcades, and it was just a screaming match between various fighting games.
Yeah,
hardware.
I mean, that's kind of, you know, for people of our age, that is kind of, you know, what arcade, because I guess like arcades to some extent did have a little bit of a downturn before being obvious, before they actually had this surge with Street Fighter 2. You know,
in the early 80s, there was a downturn. It started like at the very, very early 80s in Japan, and I think a little bit later in the West. So yeah, like there was a downturn there, and then
by the time we would be old enough to see arcade games, it was one-on-one fighter palooza. It was
right. Everybody was making one
so dominant because Street Fighter 2 was just such a a global phenomenon or whatever. Because stupid and dumb as that phrase is, I mean, it it lives up to that as much as
because if you walked into an arcade. Even when I was a kid, and I remember it like around 90, if you walked into an arcade, it would be a Street Fighter II machine, a couple SNK machines, maybe as many as three, because one of them would be a shooter, and then they'd have a fighting game or two. There's probably a Street Fighter knockoff. And if you go a few more years, then you throw a Mortal Kombat game in there.
Yeah, Mortal Kombat comes in. Then you obviously started to get like the Polygonal Fighters, Virtua Fighter,
right.
Tekken. You know, I mean, it was just so, so dominant in that kind of time frame. But before that, it was a bit different, but that's really before my time.
Right, and those games did make that jump cleanly to home consoles. Because, we talked about it, was it last week? Everybody had a version of Donkey Kong. Now they were mostly bad due to malfeasance, but everybody had one. You know, everybody had their Space Invader. Everybody had their, you know, just run down the list.
Galaga, Pac-Man. I mean, pretty serious planks of any lineup.
Yeah, so it was really things, you know, when you start getting towards these dedicated hardware, you see things like RPGs and stuff popping up that you just couldn't do in the arcade. I can't imagine, like, you're going to grind for 20 hours in this arcade game. It just doesn't work. But to me personally, what I would love to see and what I miss from the arcades, and I kind of point to a very specific moment in my childhood, I guess adolescence at this point, There was Sega put out, because they were still doing this, this big honking cabinet of the Star Wars, the arcade game.
Oh, yes.
And it was gigantic. And it was this huge tube television that was playing a mix of graphics and I feel like there was probably some video going on in there, too. And your controls were a button and a joystick. And, like, it was just a big, dumb experience. And I got really good at that game to the point where I could beat it on one continue,
like, it just
I think.
Pounded Star Wars music into the arcade.
Oh, it was
so...
So
straight away,
it
I was like...
it took up so much space, too. I vividly remember this dumbass arcade game that you would get on a two sets of skis that was mounted on like a wheel essentially on its side, and you had to turn the skis while holding onto this bar, and it was there was I want to say it was some degree of movement too. It was the dumbest, worst conceived idea for an arcade game ever. Basically, it's saying how can we simulate the impact of hurting yourself skiing while actually letting you hurt yourself from the comfort of an arcade.
Right. Well, the thing is, so I where I grew up, there was no, you know, local arcade place. But there was like this popular festival, like this fair. And basically, so every year there would be a tent with arcade games in it. And for several years, that Alpine Racer by Namco, which I think is what you're talking about, that was like the most popular thing in the tent. Like there were other games. I think that, you know, like mostly fighting games had come and gone. The golden age of fighting games was over, and when I really started seeing these kind of gimmicky, like Top Skater, I think, and Alpine Racer, just kind of dominate. And you would see, you know,
Top Skater was garbage.
You would see drunk people with Western, like cowboy hats, because this was a Western festival. you know, just try the skiing stuff, and just with a crowd around them or just their buddies. And I don't think I ever tried them, because it just, yeah, it didn't look like it would simulate the experience all that well.
Top Skater was neat and terrible at the same time, because it was basically the Tony Hawk ride board before the Tony Hawk ride.
Right. That's what it looked like.
It
and
pivoted,
yeah,
too. It was trash. But I played the hell out of it, because it was this big, like, it had guardrails. Like, this game is so dangerous, it needs guardrails. It's like, what are we doing? And it's bumping out like faux 90s like rock music, like from the Vans Warped Tour that never happened. It was terrible. Oh, I loved it.
No, but I think, you know, with in terms of, like, you know, where can we find like that kind of arcade spirit today? I mean, it's kind of interesting, because where he talks about progress meters and RPG mechanics and stuff, I mean, there was a move to do that kind of thing to arcade staples, you know, on the NES, you know, like that. You know, you think of something like River City Ransom. You know, like all those years ago, like that was kind of an approach for saying, okay, well, you know, we can't maybe do the flashiest, like, you know, a brawler as flashy as an arcade one, but what can we do that you couldn't do there, and kind of embellish it in some way, you know, and take the kind of the same kind of gameplay fundamentally, and then kind of turn it into a more extensive or perhaps a more deep experience. And, you know, and I guess, you know, yet there are indie games today that are doing similar things to arcade staples, in terms of, you know, we've had the question in the past about the roguelike elements, which is a phrase you see a lot now in even in descriptions on the Switch eShop. You know, it's that pervasive now, roguelike elements.
Or
RPG elements. Obviously, that was, you know, very, you know, that came into the lexicon a long time ago and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, I guess the point there being that, you know, the feeling is like it's not enough now that a game be like a pure arcade experience. You know, that's too slight. to kind of get people to pay what might even be, you know, fairly modest prices in the digital stores of today. Perhaps so. Yeah, it's I guess for people who are big fans of the really pure arcade kind of experience, it may be they lament that fact that it, you're kind of having to dilute it to try and sell it today, because it's just, you know, this all kind of dollars to hours calculation that, right, that goes on in people's heads and in the discourse out there. I mean, I could see that point of view, from Adria, but also I would say those games, I feel like, have a sort of a use, a kind of a place, in the sense that I think they might bring those kind of gameplay styles to people who otherwise wouldn't try them.
Right.
And
I mean,
it, you know, if they can actually kind of get get used to them there, and say, oh, actually, you know, this is quite simple in a way compared to, like, you know, the sort of the contemporary big console games, but I like this, something about it, then maybe, you know, they might go back and buy, you know, some Neo Geo games that are also on Switch, or which are literally arcade games.
Right, it's a dip Switch flick, basically.
Yeah, and you know, and enjoy those as well. So, you know, I feel like it's... I get what he's saying, but at the same time, I feel like, you know, there's a value in those. And obviously, yeah, again, as we said before about, you know, the quarter months, some games kind of extend an arcade concept with RPG leveling and all this kind of whatever it might be better than others. You know, sometimes it feels more kind of organic, you know, than it feels just like grafted on or padding. It depends on the quality of the game.
Even you know, arcade standards like Gauntlet, the late Gauntlet game, Dark Arisen, I think was the one it was. You could sign into the game on the arcade hardware, and there was leveling mechanics in it. So your character would level up, and it would be saved when you came back to the arcade. You could pull up your character again and be stronger right out of the gate and play it some more. And that was a much like the same thing. They were attempting to drive time play, like you invest more time into this game by giving you some tangible reward for it. Because like I love Metal Slug to death, but I can beat it in an hour. And if I don't have to worry about quarters and I can just jam through it, like, you can't sell Metal Slug today. Not really. Because like I said, you could beat it in an hour. And that's like a completionist run. Like, that's everything. So yeah, like I don't know what you would do with those games unless you're just willing to say, like, this game is really short and we just sell it as what it is. And you know, some of those Dreamcast games, which were just straight up ports from Sega's arcade hardware at the time, you know, Crazy Taxi, Typing of the Dead showed up on there, which is insane to think about. But, you know, all that stuff, like, that's kind of the last time we saw somebody just straight, well, except for Namco, ported the GunCon games. But that's sort of like the last time we saw a dedicated hardware manufacturer go down that well, and it didn't go super great for them. And that was almost 20 years ago now. So, yeah, that was almost 20 years ago now, Jesus.
Sure,
to me,
yeah. I just think, I mean, you know, there's probably, you know, some capacity for these kinds of games to succeed, you know, in the indie space. Obviously, you know, what I talked about, Cursed Castilla, is,
right,
you know, very much in that kind of mold. I'm not sure how sort of successful it is in general, but, you know, there is a place for the pure arcade kind of experience, you know, with indie games, I think, to find a home, even if it's, you know, going to be maybe, you know, not like terribly mainstream or whatever, which is kind of ironic considering, you know, one of the things we sort of think about with arcade games is being kind of instantly accessible.
To me, like the most successful arcade games at home, I don't know if there's one recipe to have kind of a successful kind of transition or successful where it doesn't feel too shallow and you want to go back to it, and but also it doesn't lose sight of what an arcade game is. But, you know, Pac-Man Championship DX comes to mind. And it's just like, it was just this really well-made score attack game with a multitude of modes, but the default one just had you go through a board for 5 minutes, And so it wasn't, you know, too demanding of people's time. Like you didn't end up playing this game forever to try to beat your highest score like you would in like a pinball game.
Pinball, yeah, it's true. The time limit kind of made it something you could go back to try and top much more readily than you would in a case like pinball.
Yeah, and also like it had like solid, you know, leaderboard options, and you could.
And he kind of had like the grading. I think, well, at least in this might be the sequel I'm thinking of, but you know, in terms of like you kind of he was grading your score along the curve of, you know, everybody's scores. So you know, in addition to just that, oh, I'm number whatever. You know, in the in your region or in the world, you know, it would actually give you like a medal to say, okay, you're in the, you know, this is you're relatively scoring very well on this particular kind of challenge, and then that right. might tell you, you know, which other challenges you weren't doing so well at. So just having online and having the ability to kind of contextualize the scores, obviously it's great when you've got like online friends that you're competing with and all that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, that's the other component I was going to bring up. Like if you couldn't compete with, you know, people from across the world, at least like maybe you could try to compete with the people on your friends list.
Yeah, high school games, I've got a real kind of soft spot for. You know, I played a lot of Yoshi Touch and Go, you know, which, you know, you mean it's a totally an arcade-style experience, you know, with a score attack experience, but you didn't have any leaderboards or anything like that to contextualize it and to drive you. So, you know, I probably could have played a lot longer. So, and I tell you, Switch needs Pac-Man Championship Edition DX in some form. Would, because the amount of time I spent playing that, you know, on PS3, where you got to be in front of the TV and everything, I mean, it would have exploded on the Switch. Needs to happen big time.
I think it's for your benefit that it doesn't.
No, it's so much fun.
There were a lot of those on WiiWare. The Bit Trip games come to mind. So there's our opportunity to give us the pitch of send us the WiiWare games before the service dies that you really care about, including your arcade-inspired WiiWare titles. Same email, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. So, Greg, would you read the next email?
Sure. Jamie writes, "Hey, Alpha and crew, the Switch and 3DS, for that matter, has seen its fair share of retro revivals, remakes, and ports of older games. One game that caught my attention was Wonder Boy and the Dragon's Trap. Like most people I know, I had no idea what the Sega Master System even was until years after its release. Even though I loved playing Sonic on my Genesis as a kid, I especially knew nothing about Wonder Boy and its amazingly convoluted series of sequels and spin-offs. I bought Dragon's Trap simply because it looked so beautiful. As a kid, I always yearned for my games to look like the art on the boxes and manuals. While this remake departs from the original art, the spirit remains the same, and I had a blast playing through the game. While its retro roots show a bit too glaringly in some spots, overall the game held up very well, bolstered by remarkable production values. It's especially cool to see that Dragon's Trap was more successful on Switch than other platforms combined. Seeing this game got me thinking, what retro or overlooked games would you like to see given a similar treatment? I immediately thought of something like Zelda 2. There's a good game in there somewhere, and I think with modern design tweaks and characters that actually help you, this game could be given a second lease on life. Or a first lease on life if you can't get around some of the game's major flaws. Would love to hear your opinions. And no one wants to see a reimagining of Mylon's Secret Castle. That game is probably best left as a secret.
I mean, I could use like hand-drawn walls I have to drill into, sure. But besides that, no, I'm good. Who has one they want to just lead with? Because I'm still mulling my answer.
Well,
over
certainly,
a bit.
I mean, the Zelda 2 one is an important, I think, example because you know, we did that for Retroactive a long time ago, and you know, there was definitely aspects of the game that I enjoyed, but structurally, and again, like even a game like that, which was very ambitious, you know, in many ways for its day.
Absolutely.
Had like an arcade sensibility to it that made no damn sense. You know, like that's the thing. I mean, you know, the way that, you know, you kind of lose progress and so, you know, it's just very sort of awkward at that point. You know, I guess people didn't really have the full confidence to break from the, you know, some of those conventions. Even when they were trying to do something that was clearly, you know, very different from the typical arcade genres, they were kind of wedded to it. And I just think now, you know, with all those years of detachment, they could, you know, really kind of take a critical eye to it and do it a lot of good.
The line that he includes about characters that actually help you, I almost wonder if that would take away something from this game of actually having meaningful information from your NPCs versus just the complete horseshit they usually give you.
Yeah, so Simon's Quest is, you know, similar.
Oh my god! Like that's a game that could use a remake. But again, I almost wonder if you ruin what makes that game special by not making it just completely broken. Because, like, I'm not sure at its core Simon's Quest is a good game regardless.
I don't know. There's a lot of things you could talk about with Simon's Quest that people will remember, you know, some of the bizarre kind of non sequitur puzzle things and the unhelpful characters and stuff like that. But the actual, like, mansions where you kind of do regular Castlevania stuff aren't that great. And that's where I think it would really benefit from a remake, is like, okay, let's actually put some like quality Castlevania style action level design and bosses in these things.
But that, I mean,
and,
that game...
sometimes, I don't know, like I remember, what is that guy's name? Hortberg? The guy who made Gunman Clive. So the designer of Gunman Clive tweeted when Samus Returns came out that, this is a good game, but it seems almost ashamed of the original, or doesn't really like elevate it more. Like,
walks far away from what that game
right. Yeah, sidesteps it. And so, you know, by kind of making Castlevania 2 a good Castlevania game, do not risk, as James mentioned, just that kind of missing the point and not
that
really.
That game is remembered because of its fuckery. And if you were,
mostly I remember just using the holy water to break floors.
Test for which floors were real.
Right. Right. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's. I mean, breaking it would have been one thing, but no. I mean, just like, well, okay, some of these blocks are not really there, and
you've got to throw holy water
all over the place to figure out which ones you're gonna fall through.
Yeah. Oh, and that's a finite resource. So good job. Yeah. Like that game. That game almost benefits from a standpoint of its memory because it's. It's coded by sadists. Like,
yeah, it's so idiosyncratic that it kind of stands out in our memory. And also, it just seemed to be, it was full of secrets, right? Just freaking where to go was a big freaking secret. So
hold
it
down
was,
for 15 seconds or shit like that. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it was tantalizing as a kid when you had lots of time on your hands and a weekend rental that you had to try to have fun with.
The thing is, like, a lot of that shit is apparently just because they couldn't be bothered to translate it correctly. Like, in many cases,
it's kind of mixed in terms of here. Well, in the Japanese version, there were characters that were not helpful, like, deliberately, like, it was written that way, like, not all of the villagers are being straight with you or whatever. But then you've got the busted translation stuff on top of that. So it was a compound problem. I mean, like I said, what we're talking about with a Zelda 2 remake and Simon's Quest, I would say, is quite different from what they did with the Dragon's Trap remake, because that is just the game, right? I mean, the graphics are new, but you can also like switch to the old graphics on the fly. You know, the mechanics and all that kind of stuff is all intact. And so, you know, the fact that you know, we've got this far, and Jamie thinks that, you know, it holds up really well, you know, says something about the quality of the original game in that respect, you know, that it didn't need to be overhauled in the fashion that we're kind of talking about with, you know, Metroid 2, you know, or Zelda 2, Simon's Quest. But, you know, I still think there's a... I mean, I hear what's, you know, been said about, you know, how much is it really connected to the original game at a certain point if you you're kind of really going so different with it and overhauling it so much. But I do like those kinds of remakes as well, where it's like, you know, let's, like I said, you bring that kind of modern sense of like what, you know, belongs in a home game and what is a sort of weird vestige of an arcade game that should never have been in it in the first place, and really kind of use those sort of standards to reshape it into something that you know, hopefully does still carry some of the spirit of the original and what was kind of enticing about it, but can actually, you know, bring it to a lot more people because it's a lot more sort of playable and accessible than it was before.
I think a good source that we could take kind of, you know, kind of games that hold up in the gameplay department but don't look so great would be the Game Boy, you know, as a platform. And I'm thinking specifically, like, I wouldn't mind getting a remake of the first Wario Land, but with graphics, like the graphics of Shake It. And I do think they would have to rework a few things because, you know, the Game Boy screen was so small, the character
screen,
was
yeah,
so big.
The play area, yeah.
Yeah, so they would probably have to create new levels, but I think that they could probably manage to create something that approximates the levels of the original and, you know, make it the whole thing, like, compatible with 16:9 screens and all of that. But yeah, like, I would love to see something like that. And maybe, why not, like, so, like a Mario Land compilation where kind of like All-Stars, but with the Game Boy games. And, well, the thing is, Nintendo would probably give them the look of New Super Mario, so yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But that's, on that, the other kind of Castlevania 2, Belmont's Revenge on Game Boy, is kind of it's like the good Game Boy Castlevania,
right?
Because
the one that hasn't been remade,
well, the one that's not been re-released, yeah, because that's the when they did Game Boy Virtual Console, they put out the Adventure, you know, which was an early Game Boy game. So I guess, you know, it's kind of there's a lot of people that probably associate it with like early Game Boy memories, but I haven't even played that because it's meant to be so shite. Which really, right. I mean, with the amount of Castlevania games I've played, that should tell you how poorly that game is regarded.
Yeah.
But I have played Castlevania 2 Belmont's Revenge and quite enjoyed it. But it does seem like, you know, it's just they're not bringing it to anybody, you know, for whatever reason. So, you know, it'd be nice if we can't get a re-release, then a remake would be very nice instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I kind of wonder what would be what I would want out of an NES game or a game of that era that I have trouble separating those games from the era I played them in. So it would be hard for me to go like, oh yeah, like that game would really benefit from modern. It's only the games where I look at them and go, that game was fucked that I can do that. And in most cases, I don't want those games to be remade. So I kind of end up looking a little bit further in, like a little bit closer to modern. And there's a bunch of like GBA games and Game Boy games that Game Boy Color games in particular that could use like some kind of movement up. I think they could absolutely have done something. Looking at one of our other retroactive games, they could have absolutely done something with all the RPGs that came out on the Game Boy Color and Game Boy Advance. But something like oh, what was that Pokemon card game? Pokemon the trading card game.
Yeah, the retro.
You just named it.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if that was the official name or if they had some kind of like subtitle-y shit on there for the Game Boy Advance one. Like that game worked remarkably well within the confines of what it was being asked to do. Or even like we just got Golf Story, but even like the GBA Mario Tennis, like there's stuff there that works. Pretty much all.
Well, on that note, Pokemon spin-off reboot. A new Snap is something that people have asked for ages, and it's
I don't look at that game and say like the technical problems or the design issues. It's just that game's old. Like,
well, it's just a question of, you know, how much better the Pokemon could look now, and you know, all the other Pokemon that could be included. So
and how much faster that game could move?
Yes, exactly. No, and I mean, like, because you've got, you know, like gyro enabled, you know, Switch and all that kind of stuff. And that, I mean, it seems so perfect.
Yeah.
But you know, even just a straight remake of the N64 game that just made the Pokemon look pretty would be pretty good.
Like it's stuff that it's closer in. So like I would always be down for full consoleized level graphics of like a late era Mega Man game, so a Zero or an X. You know, I never really got into 9 and 10 that much because 8-bit Mega Man's, you know, to borrow the phrase, not my Mega Man. It's not the Mega Man I grew up with. So, like, I see it, it's like, oh, yeah, okay. So, like, seeing the Super Nintendo style done closer to what the cartoons look like, or in the case of X, what the box art looked like. In the case of Zero, what the big poster that came in there looked like, that looked really cool, but then you realized, oh yeah, this is Game Boy Advance. There's only so much it can do. All right, well, we meandered in the extreme today. So we only got through two emails. This is a new low. We have hit a new low for us. But that's okay, because we live to hit lows, as you probably have deduced. So you can send us your email, and we may spend anywhere from between 5 minutes and 5 hours on it to RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. You can also send suggestions for end music, which I assume someone did this week. Greg, what do we have?
Okay, so TJ requested a track from Mega Man 10 that you just mentioned there.
Yeah, that may have been a knowing drop.
Yes, Solar Inferno, unsurprisingly the theme for Solar Man stage in that game, with great 8-bit style Mega Man music. But we also have the Wii Shop Channel shout out for this week to deal with. Mega Man 10, of course, I played it on the Wii Shop Channel. Through WiiWare, but it is available a bunch of other places. But the request we've got in this department is from Jonathan, who chose Motor Heroes, which is also the subject of an RFN retroactive.
It's like retroactive week here.
Back in episode 289. The game was not very old at the time, but
no,
I think it was just kind of a WiiWare retroactive, because, you know, that it was back in like 2012, so you know, Wii U was coming at the end of the year, and
WiiWare had really slowed down to just fireplaces and fish tanks at that point.
It was another, a different phase of reflection on WiiWare even then. We did have a retroactive on it, but to quote what Jonathan said, he said, "I have to give a shout out to Motor Heroes. I feel like I'm the only person who's ever liked this game. It's a great game in that it's a fun mix of genres, but that hybrid nature is a bit of a drawback when you start explaining the game to people and they look at you like you're having a stroke."
That's fair.
He tries to demonstrate it's like Excitebike meets Sonic with a lot of exploring for collectibles, but you can play 4-player, and then it's more like New Super Mario Brothers when people don't cooperate meets Mario Kart. Plus, when the guy dies, he lets out this blood-curdling scream. Is actually really funny.
I you know what? No, I just had a stroke, so we're right on point there.
Yeah, I struggle to remember how warm everyone was back on that.
I seem to recall Johnny liked it. I think we were largely confused.
It's the Trials HD people. Yes, made Motor Heroes. Yeah.
And it was recommended to us at the time as well. I believe it won a poll that was a bunch of recommendations for WiiWare retroactive.
Yeah, that reflective feature back then. So yeah, some other people do like the game, I'm not sure how much the participants, how warm they were back then, but that retroactive on episode 289 is there for anyone that's interested.
There you go. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that is going to do it for us this week. Thanks to both of you for joining us. John is...
No thanks to John.
John is... I mean, if he asks, tell him that I came up with a really good crime that was so dastardly you can't say it. Or just tell him I told you he was busy at work and I didn't care. Whatever. You know, what's he going to do? Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.